It's a joy to greet you all in the name of the Lord. I wish you a pleasant, satisfying, fulfilling 2017. It is hard to believe that it is 4 weeks since I was last with you. You had a week with Neil, and then we had 2 weeks off. It's now 4 weeks. Time just rushes on. But we've done all right. I bring you greetings from the family. We were together for a week down in Mexico. But anyhow, it was a wonderful time together with our kids and grandkids to celebrate lots of things. We celebrated Christmas together. We celebrated our 50th anniversary, retirement, good health with our kids. This guy over here is the one who had the cancer a couple of years ago, so all is well. And the Cubs won the World Series. So lots of reasons to just have fun, and we did. And by the grace of God, we all survived it. And we're still smiling. I think this was the second last day, and so we made it. You know how that goes. Well, our agenda today is back into the gospel according to Moses, the book of Deuteronomy, which in Hebrew is much more appropriately called These Are the Words, rather than Deuteronomos, Second Law. There's so much more here than law. What you call something matters, and sometimes it gets us off on the wrong track. Well, our text today will start out with verses 10 to 13 and see if we get into the part beyond that. But just to set the stage where we have been, this chapter 29 and 30 is kind of a four-act drama of divine grace. We have come through verses 1 to 8, where Moses has been summarizing past grace. He has been looking back and how gracious God has been in bringing the Israelites to this point. Our first agenda today is the present celebration of grace, and we'll see how that works, and then the plot will continue after that. So what we have in verses 10 to 13, I'm always confused here because the Hebrew numbers and the English numbers in Deuteronomy 29 are all off by one. So sometimes I'm working with one and sometimes the other. But I think this is right by your English translations, verses 10 to 13. So let's begin by reading this. A reminder that we're now back home. We're not looking back and we're not looking to the future. He is reflecting here on the significance of everything that's happening reflected in the book of Deuteronomy. What is this moment? And here he has it. You are standing today, all of you, in the presence of the Lord your God. Your leaders, your tribes, your elders, your officials, all the men of Israel, your children, your wives, the foreigners who are in your camps, who cut your wood and draw your water, so that you may enter into the covenant of the Lord your God and into his oath, which he is making with you today, and so that he may establish you today as his people, so that he may be your God as he promised you and as he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is a summary statement of all that is happening on the plains of Moab. The covenant is being renewed today so that this generation that was not at Sinai, that was their fathers, and they blew it and they died in the desert. God is starting over with a new race. What's happening here is they are being plugged into Sinai, the covenant that was made at Sinai. In fact, as we'll talk about when we get to the end, they're being plugged into something far earlier than that. In any case, let's break this down on your notes. If you have them, I reduced it here to the principal clause and the principal subordinate clauses. If you take away the fluff, this is what this text is about. You are standing this day before the Lord your God that you may enter into the covenant and to his sanctions, and that he may confirm you as his people and he may be your God. That is the point of this text. A couple of things we should talk about here. One, you are standing today. It's important to notice that people don't sit in the presence of God. There's only one person in all of Scripture who sits in the presence of God. That's David. In 2 Samuel 7, David was sitting before the Lord. This is just after the Lord has announced to him the eternal messianic covenant. That he is sitting before the Lord. On what grounds does he have authority to do that? Nobody else. Well, there's an Eli character who sits on his throne. That's the word in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Or is it chapter 1? Who sits on his throne in front of the temple. That's a part of Eli's problem. He's a problem character. What's he doing there? But here, David is saying, you stand in the presence of the Lord. This is not the normal word for stand. You are nitzavim. That's a great Hebrew word. This is an official moment. There's a more common Hebrew word for stand. This is not that. In chapter 4, verse 10, there he's reflecting how at Sinai, the Lord told Moses to assemble the people and they stood. Remember the day you stood before the Lord your God. Different verb there. This one is even more official than that one. This is an official moment. Something legal is happening here. What is that legal thing? Well, who's all standing? It's interesting when you see this. This is not a segregated world. First Testament worship is inclusive from beginning to end. And so you have at the end of chapter 31, Moses will say, when you celebrate the festival of booths every seventh year, you shall read this entire Torah to the people in the presence of your men, your women, your children, your aliens in your town. They're all, you all come. Ezra or Nehemiah chapter 9, when Ezra gathers or the people gather and they want Ezra to read the Torah, the text says they all came, men, women, children. Worship was not segregated, and it isn't here. So that when you get to the time of the New Testament and Herod's temple, you remember there's a court of the Gentiles and a court of the women. That's not biblical. That's something that had, Herod's temple is a political statement that reflects Judaism of the day and whatever. It is not an inspired blueprint like you have for the tabernacle or for David's temple or for the temple at the end of the book of Ezekiel. It is a man-made project. And there you've got a court of the Gentiles, which reminds us of what has been happening in the intertestamental period. This notion of inclusiveness has been segregated so that at the beginning of each day, some Orthodox Jewish men would thank the Lord every day that I was not born a dog or a woman. You know, that kind of, that is not in the Hebrew Bible. That comes out of somewhere else. And when Paul starts talking about, in Galatians and elsewhere, in Christ there's neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, he's not fixing an Old Testament problem. He's fixing a problem that arose in the interim. And so here are the participants. You have three groups. First of all, he names four. These are the officials, your leaders, your tribal leaders. It's strange. It's literally your tribes. But in this context, it obviously means the heads of the tribes and your elders and your officials. We expect them to be there. And this is what's different here than at Sinai, in a sense. Remember at Sinai when they went up to the mountain to have the feast in the presence of God? Who was there? 70 elders. 70 elders. Here it's totally democratized, as you see. He adds then, every man of Israel, your children, your wives, your foreigners, those who are in your camps, who cut your wood and who draw your water, y'all come. This is not a segregated business. The participants, this is a national moment where everybody is signing on to the covenant, which is why in the next text, or the next paragraph, he will talk about an individual who goes off track. And it's not just an official, it's any individual from Israel. Well, the interesting thing here is that he includes the foreigners who are in your camps and cut your water. This kind of expression, who cut your wood and draw your water, you have that notion. You hire aliens to do some of the grunt work. And this comes from, this is common, 31st to 12th century. There's a lovely typo there. How does that work? I'm dyslexic. Reading the numbers the wrong way. Sweep from the fields the men cutting wood, and from the threshing floors the women picking straw. Sweep from the well the women drawing water, and from the spring the women filling jars. Well, it's just an addition here that you are not to exclude anybody here just because somebody is out there doing work. They're all invited to this. The whole gang is there. So it's who's participating? Everybody. What's the purpose of this event? This becomes even more important here. The purpose is expressed as to pass into the covenant of the Lord your God. This is the only place in all of Scripture where you have this expression. We have other expressions to enter into the covenant of the Lord your God, or to make a covenant of the Lord your God, or to cut a covenant. This is the most common. In fact, we'll have it in a few verses later. To cut a covenant, to make a covenant. What does it mean to pass into a covenant? I think the best way to illustrate, some of you have seen this before, this is my diagram of what Abraham is doing in Genesis chapter 15, where you have a literal cutting of the covenant. Abraham cuts these animals in half, and he sets the halves opposite each other. And there he sees, while he's in a coma here, he sees the Lord passing through. And this is how the Lord is entering into the covenant, or passing into the covenant. By the time the torch representing God has gone through, God has put his life on the line. So be it to me and more if I ever forget to be true to the covenant. So that's what's going here. The purpose of this is very formal. We are formalizing the covenant with this generation. I have another illustration. Those of you who were with us about 5 years ago might remember. But here's a literal illustration of cutting the covenant. I went to Ashlaka. They brought me a young dog and a she-goat in order to conclude a covenant. Literally here, the Akkadian word, the Babylonian, Assyrian word, is to kill a donkey foal. That's the Assyrian expression or Babylonian expression for making a covenant, to kill a donkey foal, between the Chananeans and the land of Idumarats. But in deference, I did not permit the use of the young dog and the she-goat, but instead had a donkey foal, which is normal, the young of the she-ass killed, and thus established a reconciliation between Chananeans and the land of Idumarats, literally cutting the covenant, like we have here. That's the point of this, to pass into the covenant of the Lord your God. But what does that involve? If you look again at your text, you'll see that's not just a general statement. What happens when we pass? To pass into the covenant of the Lord your God, verse 12, and into his oath. Into his oath, which the Lord your God is making with you today. What does that tell you? His oath. That, you can interpret that two ways. What's one way? Pardon me? God or man? In what sense? The oath that God made with you. Which is a wonderfully comforting notion, isn't it? We always think of this only as something the Israelites sign on to. But it's his oath in that he has already signed on to this. So what you are doing now is accepting the gift of covenant with this ceremony. And of course, the other way of interpreting it is to say the oath that God prescribes for you to make. And that is true as well. So that at Sinai, the oath takes the form of sprinkling blood on the altar, binding God to Israel, and then sprinkling the blood on the people. That is the physical, symbolic gesture of oath making. Covenants always involve an oath ceremony. In some places, you read simply in Ezekiel chapter 16, he says, I raised the hand for you. That is God's way of saying, I entered into covenant relationship with you. But here, they're passing into the, which means it is a binding thing on both parties. Third, it is to confirm Israel as a people. Well, now you start to see the benefits of this, that you might enter into the oath that the Lord your God is making with you today in order that he may establish you today as his people. Again, some of you remember the expression we used earlier. This is making real what we call the covenant formula. I will be your God, and you shall be my people. You have variations of that formula dozens of times in Scripture. It's the oath, or that formula itself, is closely related both to adoption formulas and marriage formulas. In a marriage context, you would say, I will be your husband and you will be my wife. And the wife would say, I will be your wife and you will be my husband. In adoption formula, I will be your father. And if the person is of age, the child would say, I will be your father and you will be my son. And if the person is of age, I will be your son and you will be my father. You have an allusion to this in Psalm 89. There are two messianic psalms. Psalm 89, actually, where David talks about this way with God. He is the Lord's adopted son in a very particular sense, which has implications when you get to the baptism of Jesus. This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Well, in any case, to confirm Israel as his people, and you expected this, and to confirm, to establish you as his people, and that he may be your God, just as he spoke to you, as he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is the other side. Israel becomes God's possession, and God offers himself as Israel's possession. And the covenant, this is the point of the covenant. Now, again, that last comment is important. God is hereby fulfilling the word that he gave. He swore. And when God swears, he always keeps his oath. Hebrews talks about there are two immutable things, the oath and the promise of God. Well, here is the oath. On the plains of Moab, God is fulfilling that which he told to the ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, when did he do this? We can go to a couple of places, Exodus chapter 6, verses 2 to 8, where just before Moses goes to Pharaoh, and again, the second time, and tells him to let the people go, God speaks to Moses and says to him, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob as El Shaddai. But by my name, Yahweh, I didn't make myself known to them. That's a very difficult thing, comment, because you have the name Yahweh all over Genesis. And my own sense is that what he's saying here is the full meaning of the name Yahweh you didn't yet get. Which is why at the beginning of Exodus, when the Lord introduces himself to Moses, he says, I will be who I will be. And that's an invitation to Moses to get ready for the unpacking of the name of God. Yahweh. Who is this person? And that is revealed in the Exodus and then at Mount Sinai. They didn't know the full meaning of this name, Yahweh. Y-H-W-H. We don't know exactly how it was pronounced. But they used it somewhere along the line, even as early as Seth, Genesis 4. Then people began to call upon the name of the Lord. Capitals, all capital, L-O-R-D, all caps. That means Yahweh. In my view, God must have revealed his name to the people at a very early stage and invited them to address him this way without unpacking what that means. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they lived as sojourners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the peoples of Israel, whom the Egyptians hold as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. And of course, this is what motivated the Exodus. Exodus chapter 2, God heard the groan. No, the people cried out to God and God heard. And he knew. It says he remembered his covenant and he knew. And then it doesn't say what he knew. I think it means simply, it's time to act. The moment has arrived, which I predicted in Genesis 15. So that's Exodus 2. Oh, we got a little bit more. Say therefore to the people, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of Egypt. There you have that formula. I will be your God, you will be my people. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'll give it to you as a possession. So this is all in fulfillment of that. These people are being brought into the relationship promise there. But it goes way back farther than that. Genesis 17, 7 to 8, where he tells Abraham, I will establish my covenant. And at this point, it means confirming that covenant which we have now made with your descendants. The covenant between me and you, I will establish it with your offspring and throughout their generations as an eternal, irrevocable covenant to be God to you and to your offspring to you. I will give to you and your offspring after you the land of the sojourning, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. That's what's happening here. on the plains of Moab, so that when they cross the Jordan tomorrow, a metaphor, it's not literally tomorrow, but in the very near future, they are not going in as a private band of, what shall we say, Vikings or Philistines. They're going in as the people of the Lord in fulfillment of the promises and to fulfill the mission that God had established for them a long, long time ago. Well, this is actually a very, very important text to understand the book of Deuteronomy. This is what happens in the book. Here, this generation, born in the desert in the 40 years of wandering, now formally become the people of the Lord. All right, any questions, comments, eggs, tomatoes?
Everyone can come.
Yes.
I've forgotten why some people are excluded because they're mutilated. Some people can't be in the congregation because they're mutilated. Can they come too?
The question here, this looks like everyone can come, but earlier in chapter 24, we read that some people, Moabites, Ammonites, and mutilated people, whose genitals are deformed, crushed, or whatever, are not invited to the Kahal Yahweh. That's a problem. Would they have been here? My sense is that they would have been here. They're all here. There are no perfect specimens, but there would have been imperfect. There's a difference between entering into the sanctuary and entering along with the rest of the people in this. That's how I would go with this one. This is there he is talking about formal participation, a certain level of sanctuary worship. I don't know. It's a problem. I'm not totally clear on this. Yes, sir.
I think that the first verse of Hebrews sheds light on that. And God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers, in the prophets, in many portions, in many ways. And to me that means like in little bits and pieces, little pieces of the puzzle, in these last days has spoken to us in Son.
Yes.
And then he goes on to explain who Jesus is.
Yes.
And so I think there's a lot of things that are hard to understand.
Yes.
When you just have pieces.
The point here is Hebrews 1 reminds us that God spoke in many different ways in the past, in bits and pieces, as in these last days declared to us fully in Christ what it's all about. I think we're going to get there, that verse, bring it up again when we get to verse 29. The secret things belong to the Lord our God. Or we could probably translate this. There, God has lots of secrets that we don't get. And I think this is a part of the mystery. How in the world is it possible for God to take a people like Israel, and there's nothing particularly noble about this people? How is it possible for him to take a people like this and enter into this bond of fellowship and covenant relationship? I think that's a part of the issue here. In any case, this is a momentous occasion. All right, let's go on to the next paragraph. Tomorrow. We've just been talking about today. Three or four times we had today, today, today. This is what's happening today. Ah, but now we've got a warning. If you have signed on tomorrow, watch out what you do with what you signed on to. He is now looking ahead, and he is telling us that we're not only making a covenant with this generation, we're making it with the next one. I'm going to skip some of this, and let's just move right into the text. Verses 14 to 28 actually divide into two parts. We should probably read the whole thing in a moment here. The first part, verses 14 to 21, deal with personal consequences of individual infidelity. He's now becoming very particular. You all have signed on. What happens in the future if one of you decides to go another way? And then in verses 22 to 28, we've got geographical consequences of corporate infidelity. It's a very logically structured text here. On the one hand, he's talking about, well, the whole nation has signed on to God. Does that mean that every individual is now, shall we say, a victim of that oath and you can't get out of it? And he will be reminding us, hey, watch it. You can be excluded from the benefits. And then at the end, he'll talk about the national consequences. Again, reminding us where we've been, past experience of grace, the present celebration of grace. Today you've become the people. Well, what we're talking about now, future spurning of grace. Let's read this text. It's not with you alone that I am making this covenant and this oath, but also with those who are standing here with us today before the Lord your God, and with those who are not here with us today. And at this point, he is not thinking about some people who slept in. He's thinking about future generations. But before he gets there, he says, you yourselves know how we lived in the land of Egypt, how we passed through the midst of the nations through which we passed. It's a bit redundant here at this point. We've lived in Egypt. We've passed through the land of the Edomites and the Moabites and the Amorites on the other side of the Jordan River. And you've observed their detestable objects, their stinking idols of wood and stone, of silver and gold, which were among them. Lest, now you have it. Lest what? This is why I have this dash here. This is parenthetical. You need to read from verse 15, but also with those who are standing here with us today before the Lord your God, and with those who are not with us here today, lest among you there is a man or a woman or a clan or a tribe whose heart turns away today from the Lord our God to go and serve other gods of those nations. And lest there is among you a root bearing poisonous and bitter fruit, whatever that means, the roots bear fruit. When such a person hears the word of this sworn covenant and his heart blesses himself, saying, all is well with me, shalom li, it is well with my soul. Even though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart, this will mean the moist and the dry alike will be swept away. The Lord will not be willing to forgive him. Instead, the fury and passion of the Lord will smoke against that person. And all the curses recorded in this document will descend upon him. And the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven. And the Lord will single that person out from all the tribes of Israel for disaster in accordance with all the curses of the covenant written in this Torah document. Oops. You understand, Moses is a pastor. He's preaching here. And he's letting them know the significance. And just because you were involved in this formulaic moment, this ritual moment, doesn't mean now we can just carry on no matter what. No, it is the opposite. Watch yourselves lest. Lest. The danger remains. When we read this text, we notice that we have here another illustration of what I call resumptive exposition. Resumptive means simply he's resuming a topic that he raised earlier, and now he's picking it up and developing it more fully. And on the back of your sheet of notes that I sent you, that we sent you yesterday, you have the text, chapter 4, verses 25 to 20. That's a long time ago. That's at the end of Moses' first address. He had already intimated what he's talking about here today. So we've read this part here on the right. Now let's read this, and you can see the resemblance. When you father children and children's children and have grown old in the land. Well, now he's looking way to the distant future. If you act corruptly by making a carved image in the form of anything and by doing what's evil in the sight of the Lord your God, so as to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will soon utterly perish from the land that you're going over the Jordan to possess. You will not live long in it, but you will be utterly destroyed, and the Lord will scatter you among the peoples. You'll be left few in number among the nations where the Lord will drive you. There you will serve gods of wood and stone, the work of human hands that neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. Well, that's what we're talking about here. The problem is, the danger is going off track, idolatry. Again, we have a reminder in this text, who are the parties to the covenant? The covenant on both parties is binding in perpetuity. Verse 14, not with you alone am I making this covenant, but both with those who stand here with us today in the presence of the Lord and those who aren't with us today for you. So this is to in perpetuity. The notion of making covenants in perpetuity is very common in the ancient world. So that when one king makes a covenant with another king, it typically applies to the descendants of both. And here's an illustration: the 13th century Treaty of Tughaliya, the fourth of Khati and Kurunta of Tarkuntasa. Lovely names, these. For all time, no one shall take the kingdom of the land of Tarkuntasa away from the progeny of Muwatalli. For all time, only a descendant of Kurunta shall hold the kingship of the land of Tarkuntasa. Here's another one. A treaty of Esarhaddon regarding people's fidelity to his son Ashurbanipal, who will succeed him. The treaty of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, of Humaresh, a city of Nakshimarti, his sons, his grandsons, all the Nakshimartians, the men in his hands, young and old, as many as are from sunrise to sunset, all those over whom Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, exercises kingship and lordship with you, your sons and your grandsons, who will be born in the days to come after this treaty is signed. This is a common thing in the ancient world. And Moses is here recognizing that we have signed on here to something that is far bigger than this generation. This is something that is ad olam, forever, eternal, irrevocable, and it is guaranteed. Well, what's the problem then? The problem is idolatry. Did you notice as we were reading this, the different words that Moses uses for idolatry? You can hardly figure it out from the English translation, so I have to talk a little bit about these unpleasantries. In my translation, I had stinking idols. There's a reason for that. Now we can talk about that. Moses' attitudes. In chapter 27, verse 15, he had already used a different word. Chapter 27, 15. Cursed is the man who makes an idol or a molten image an abomination to the Lord. The work of human hands. An abomination. This is the strongest word you have in Hebrew for something that is absolutely disgusting, deplorable, objectionable, repulsive to God. It's an abomination. Idolatry is an abomination. Well, here he uses two different words, shikutsim. This is simply the ordinary word for something. We use the word nasty, disgusting, whatever. And the second one is gilulim. Gilulim. That's a very important word. It's Ezekiel's favorite word for idols. And when we were working on the New Living Translation, I remember long conversations we had about this. And if the point of a translation is to evoke in the present reader equivalent effect from what you had in the original, what are you going to do with this? And so what happens in all of the translations, it's totally sanitized. And it's made to look, less, shall we say, smelly. Gilulim, notice, shikutsim, this is the common word for something nasty and ugly. What they've done with gilulim is they've taken the word galal, which means to roll as a verb, and as a noun it means a round thing, and they've given it the vowels of shikutsim. So it's round, smelly things. Well, what are these round, smelly things? There you go. Everybody in that world would have known what he's talking about. Or if you don't like goat feces, try sheep feces. Or, I grew up on a farm. That's exactly. Or ibex. That's what we're talking about. That's what. And the first place we actually, I didn't put it in your notes. The first place we actually hear the word is in Leviticus, where the Lord uses it himself. Now Moses, this is the only place in Deuteronomy where he uses it. Now he uses it once, maybe one other time. But then by the time you get to Ezekiel, when 586 is just on the horizon, in the book of Ezekiel, this is his favorite word. In fact, I have a text here from Ezekiel. And when you see the word gilulim, you should think, for equivalent effect, a four-letter word that starts with S and ends with T. Therefore speak to... Notice, I have sanitized it. Therefore speak to them and say to them, thus says the Adonai Yahweh, any one of the house of Israel who takes this shice... I mean, you change languages just to be careful. Into his heart and sets the stumbling block of iniquity before his face, yet comes to the prophet, I am the Lord. I will answer him as he comes with a multitude of his sheep droppings, that I may lay hold of the hearts of the house of Israel, who are all estranged from me through their flesh. That's what God thinks of idols. So that when you turn to idols, instead of worshiping the one true and living God, creator of heaven and earth, who sits enthroned in the heavens and who in his mercy invites us into his presence, you're bowing down to a cow pie. This is very direct rhetoric. Moses has strong feelings about the problem. And so, as we work our way through this text, see how he develops it. Well, first of all, we have the need for the covenant is already iterated in 16 to 21. The roots of the problem, the point he's going to be making is about all this idolatry stuff, but there's a parenthetical comment. Those of us who stand with us today in the presence of the Lord our God and with those who are not here, oh, by the way, it's as if he can hardly wait to get to the topic. You know how we lived in the land of Egypt and we came through the midst of the nations. Moreover, we've seen the abominations. There it is. And their idols of wood and silver and stone. That's the problem. That's the problem. The issue here is apostasy. And of course, the point is the first and principal, the great command. You shall love the Lord your God. What does that mean? It means you shall be covenantally committed to the Lord your God so that you always act in his interest and for his glory. Always. This is the problem. You're going to be seduced by sheep pellets. The issue. We've seen this. Now, of course, when you read the stories of Exodus and so on, those stories don't say anything about idolatry in Egypt. We know about idolatry at Sinai, the golden calf. But we didn't hear anything about the idolatry in Egypt. There isn't a hint of that in these texts. When you read Ezekiel, who retells Israel's story, he says, you people have been idolaters from the beginning, including in Egypt. From the days of your youth, you've been going after idols. It's interesting when you read Ezekiel in three different chapters, 16, 20, and 23, he retells Israel's history. When we commission people to write the history of our denomination, of our church, of our town, we pick people who are going to do a good job making us all look good. When the prophets retell Israel's story, they're telling it the way God sees it. And that's often a different story. In any case, the need for the covenant is the problem of apostasy. The roots of the problem lie in verses 16 and 17. You've seen it before, but this is also a future problem. In fact, it's going to get worse. You've seen the gods and wood and stone and all of that business. But then in verse 18, so there'll be one among you, man or woman or tribe, whose heart turns away from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of those nations. Which nations? Where you are about to enter. They will now become the seductive magnet. Watch out. So the problem that looms ahead is a personal spiritual problem, and it has personal consequences. Let's look at, before we go there, we know how quickly this happened. The book of Judges starts out with, after the death of Joshua and his generation, there arose a generation that knew not the Lord nor all the things that he had done for Israel, but they went after the gods of the nations, the Amorites and the Hittites and whatever else. And that was the temptation from the very beginning. You see, the pagans worship, they've got a very physical system of worship. You can see your God. And you can dance around the image of your God. And what the Israelite religion is so abstract, you can't see your God. And it's so ethical, and it's no fun. Really? It's not how Moses talks in chapter 12 and elsewhere. But in any case, this is so physical, so tangible, the seduction of idolatry. Feel a sermon coming on. We'll hold it off. But it's the gods of the nations. This is the problem, idolatry. One illustration, and then we'll have to go. Turn to Judges chapter 17. Judges 17. It's exactly what he's talking about. Here we go. There was a man from the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. I love that name. Micah-Yahu. Who is like Yahweh? It is so orthodox. It sounds so hopeful. Oh, he said to his mother, oh, you know what? The 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse and I heard it, look, I've got it. So he's scared of the curse, but here's a guy who's stealing from his mother. He hears the curse and he says, and she says, blessed be my son by... Your translation should have all caps here. Yahweh, totally orthodox. That's the way it should go. So he returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, I dedicate the silver from my hand completely to the Lord, Yahweh, for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. And so I'm giving them back. Really? So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith and made them into the graven image, a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And the man, Micah, had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols, teraphim, and he consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every one did what was right in his own eyes. You don't need a king to lead you into apostasy. We can make it up ourselves quite well, thank you very much. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, the family, who was a Levite, and he was staying there. And the man departed from the city of Bethlehem to Judah to stay wherever he might find a place, as he made his... wherever he might find a place. It says simply, wherever he might find. There's no... Mine has a place in italics, which means they filled it in. No, you fill in the blank. Find a job, find somebody who'd affirm him, whatever. Here is a shiftless Levite who has no sense of calling or anything.